Place it comfortably. So, good morning, everyone. This is the last Dharma talk I do for the session. Tomorrow is a half day. The first theme I'd like to address, these words came from Yasutani Roshi. Yasutani Roshi was a teacher, very, very well-known teacher back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, who was one of Robert Aitken teachers, primary teachers. And I remember well in the Maui Zendo on the island of Maui in Hawaii, where I first started training with Robert Aitken back in 1978, there was a calligraphy in the main hall, which was Yasutani's calligraphy translated into English. And it said, "Don't put another head on top of your own." Mm-hmm. It's a well-known Zen saying, but he made it one of his primary teachers. Don't put another head on top of your own. And those words came back to me this morning when we were sitting in that first 1 hour sitting this morning. That sense, like at the end of the session, is I'm just one body. No, there's like it's not that sense of another head on top of my own. It's just a kind of a mind-body unity with nothing else going on. And if we reflect on what that other head is that we put on top of our own head, it's this constant commentary that's often going around in our head in everyday life. And it can be along the lines of, it can take many different forms, but for some people it can be a psychological commentary, like you're analysing your experience all the time or interpreting it, or other people's. For some people it can be a philosophical theme, you know, sort of, you know, conceptualising or theorising about what the meaning of life is, you know. But it takes on other forms as well. It can be that other head that we put on top of our own can be the comparer, the one that's always comparing ourselves with others or ourself with ourself, a better self, a worse self, etc. It's all part of the commentary. Or it can take the form of the that head on top of our own, the insecure part in us that's looking for affirmation from authority or affirmation from other people to make us feel okay, you know, to reassure ourselves whether we're going okay. But they're all of those things at the head that we put on top of our own head and cut off the head. Mm-hmm. Don't need it. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens through a whole week of intense practice, is that either that head drops off, drops into one, or at least we shrink it anyway. Uh-huh. We shrink its size, and it shrinks down. But when you had a good session, it's that sense of mind-body unity, one head on top of your shoulders, and not this extraneous commentary that constantly goes on. So take that into everyday life. When you walk down the street, you know, when you drink your coffee, just one head, not another head on top of your own. You don't need it. Okay. Now the second point is there is a sutra in our sutra reading, which someone reminded me during the session, often gives people some trouble, and they feel disconcerted by it, or it doesn't seem to make sense. So I wanted to talk about that and try and clarify it. But it comes from Tore Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow, and the words that people have a lot of difficulty with, and understandably so, is all the more we can be especially understanding and affectionate with foolish people. particularly with someone who becomes a sworn enemy and persecutes us with abusive language, and on it goes. Mm-hmm. Now, why people have difficulty with that is that it kind of looks like whatever happens to you, you've just got to suck it up, you know. You've just got to sort of turn the other cheek and swallow it, you know, and not do anything actively to respond. And so the implication there is that the practice is about being a doormat, you know. And we know how destructive, really, that is. You know, you take, like, extreme examples, say, of domestic violence, whether it's physical abuse or verbal or emotional abuse or whatever. If you took that literally, you know, you just need to cop it and think that the perpetrator is the merciful avatar of Buddha. Thank you for bashing me around the ears again, you know. It's all because of my past karma. This is the way that this teaching, Buddhism, I'm saying Zen particularly, but Buddhism, can get distorted culturally, you know, is that, you know, bad things happen to other people, it must have because it was your karma, you know, and it's not wise, it's not compassionate, it's kind of like a distortion of the teaching. And in one sense, I think it's a good teaching, I want to say, do you know? I also think in some ways it's an advanced teaching, you know. You'll see it in religious teachings outside of Buddhism as well as in Sufism particularly. You know, that someone abuses you on the street and that they are your teacher in a sense, in that if you get triggered by it and you become emotionally dysregulated by it and you either become attacking back or defensive when you fall in a heap, then it is a teaching that goes, see, you're still reactive. You've still got an identity in there that you're holding on to, and this person has triggered off your reactivity, so they're demonstrating to you that you're still holding on to something. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it is a teaching. And on the other hand, too, you can see there's some koans around this. But you can also see that one, if someone says you're effing da 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 da, in one sense, all that's happening in that moment is just those words. Just those words. That's all. Mm-hmm. So you can see it from that point of view as well. I've told this story before. It's a funny story, and it's worthwhile repeating, that when Diana and I lived in Hobart just after we were married for a number of years, they had this incident that happened where I walked into a newspaper shop, and I was just looking to buy a newspaper and just minding my own business. And this woman came into the shop, and she turned to me and she looked at me and she said, "G'day, arsehole." I didn't know who she was. Or what I'd done to offend her or whatever. But it was one of those moments where the Zen practice actually did kick in that moment. And it was like it was just those words, you know. Asshole. That's what was happening in the moment. Mm-hmm. And I actually found it funny rather than anything else. But that was someone I didn't know. Someone close to me said it might have been a different matter. But nevertheless, you know, those random things happen. And as I was talking about on a Tuesday night recently about that book, You're Not the Target, sometimes people are just having a bad day and you happen to be the one in that circumstance where they let off a bit of steam or whatever. And it's like, yeah, do you have to really take it personally? You could and be abusive back and angry back and, you know, etc., etc. But that's another way of seeing it. You know, it's just, it's life happening. But even though it may be useful to do that at times, and even to inwardly take on that practice, it's not necessarily what we would call appropriate behaviour just to be a doormat. You know, it enables abusive behaviour, it doesn't challenge it, it doesn't help anyone at all. And to use a metaphor here, and it comes from a book which is about helping people who have a friend or a family member with a borderline personality disorder, which describes someone who's very emotionally dysregulated. They're often praising you one moment and then abusing you the other. It's kind of all over the place. But it's very dramatic kind of behaviour and very challenging behaviour. And this very good book about how to live with someone with that kind of disorder in a compassionate way, that's in the title, is not to be a sponge, but to be a mirror. Good metaphor, you know, because so many people, you know, around that kind of behaviour or addictive behaviours, they just kind of become a sponge and absorb the abuse and try to be kind, etc. Oh, that's understandable because they were traumatised when they were younger, etc. But it helps no one. It helps no one to grow just to be a sponge, you know. But if you're a mirror, it's like you reflecting back the behaviour to them, this is not okay. But the best kind of response, whether you're a parent or a therapist and you're on the receiving end of that kind of dysregulated behaviour, our challenge, do you know where this comes in, is our challenge in those circumstances is to be mindful and not get hooked and not be emotionally dysregulated ourselves. And in doing that, we can be a calm but clear, steady mirror reflecting back that behaviour rather than being the sponge. So this is Zen training as well, you know, when to be discerning to challenge harmful behaviour, when sometimes just to let it go through to the keeper. There's no one way. Each situation requires its own response. But at the end of the day, this is a good teaching, because we live in a time where we're all expected to be assertive on all occasions, etc., etc., and, you know, to look after our rights and not be offended. But in its deeper religious, spiritual sense, yes, there's a kind of teaching in hearing abuse, you know, seeing it as the teacher of just life presenting itself as it is. Mm-hmm. And seeing it in that manner and see whether we get triggered or whether we don't get triggered. There's something useful in that. The third thing I'd like to talk about, well, so far during this session I've been bashing you around the ears with suffering and emptiness and impermanence and death, so a somewhat lighter topic. But a very important one, friendship, you know, and how we look at friendship from a Dharma point of view. When we go back to the Buddha's words on friendship, there's a story of where the Buddha was sitting down somewhere on a seat in a park or whatever, household, and Ananda, who was one of his students and also a cousin of the Buddha, came down and sat next to the Buddha and said, half of the holy life is friendship, companionship and good comradeship. And the Buddha replied, not so, Ananda. This is not half of the good life. This is the entire holy life. Uh-huh. Not half the life, the entire holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship. And then he went on to describe a good friend. And he made a distinction between what is a good friend and someone who actually genuinely is a good friend, And someone who just says that they're your good mate, you know, or your dear friend, you know, like the actions demonstrated. And these what he said are the characteristics of a good friend. They give what is hard to give. They do what is hard to do. They endure what is hard to endure. They reveal their secrets to you. They keep your secrets. They don't abandon you in time of trouble. They don't look down on you in times of loss. And in another way, he said they're a helper, they protect you. They're a friend in good times and bad times. They are a counsellor. They challenge you if you're doing harmful things. And they are compassionate. They don't delight in your misfortune, and they delight in your good fortune. The Buddha said some wise things about everyday life, you know? Not just about monastic life, but about everyday life. Now, you could apply all of that not only to friendship, as we call it, but you could also apply all of those things to marriage or a committed relationship, you know, or how to be a parent, you know, or maybe how to be a boss even, you know, how to be a leader. But they're wonderful reminders of, you know, the importance of friendship, you know, and when you become part of a Sangha or a Zen group or any other spiritual group, it's a friendship group, you know, and it's through friendship that it helps our practice to grow. The Buddha again said that friendship is one of the factors that leads to the awakened life. You could do it on your own, but it's sure a hell of a lot easier, you know, if you have the support of other people to assist you in it. So friendship, you know, in Dharma friendship, you know, people who are sharing a similar aspiration, you know, can really support each other in a very reciprocal kind of way to grow our maturity in the practice. And I guess what it comes back to, you know, in terms of our own practice, it's one thing to have good friends who are like this the way I'm describing, but our practice is to be a good friend. You know, if our practice is to be a good friend, then probably good friendships will come back. But it's always of a reciprocal nature. I have a friend and a colleague who been going through a very difficult time for a number of months, going through a really horrible divorce property settlement. And he went from living quite a very comfortable middle class living to now kind of being a bit of a pauper and maybe having all of his superannuation and savings taken out from underneath him and not being able to support himself in his old age. So it's quite a misfortunate, you know, experience in his life. But he keeps telling me these stories of all of this friendship group that he has across a wide... He's a spiritual man, so he's got a spiritual friendship group, and he's got people he goes swimming with and has fun with and coffee with and tells jokes with and various, very rich social life. And he regales me with all of these different stories, you know, and he really appreciates all of the enormous support he's been given back by all these friends through his adversity. And as I've fed back to him, I said, if you didn't have this friendship group around you at the moment, you'd be suicide material. Like, you'd be a real mess. And he knows that. He realises that. And what I also said to him, you know, when he was talking about how good these friends were, and I wasn't just saying it to him to, you know, boost his pride or whatever, But I said, you've got all those good friends because you are a good friend. It's true. He really is a good man who gives so generously to other people. And I suppose that's, if you want to use the karma, that's the karma of it, that if you're a good friend, it becomes a reciprocal kind of process. And I deliberately used the word reciprocal and reciprocity because friendship, true friendship, is always a two-way process. Do you know, it's not like one person has to be the giver all the time and the other the receiver. It's that we exchange those roles all the time in reciprocity. There is giving and receiving and giving and receiving. And it's worthwhile going back to the wisdom of the Buddha here, which really resonates with our understanding of relationships, like in my work as a couple therapist, is that one of the characteristics of a good friend, they reveal their secrets to you and they keep your secrets. Really important. To put it in more modern therapeutic language is that in true friendship there is an expression of vulnerability. That's what the secret is, you know, the secret shame or the fear or whatever. And in true intimate relationships, etc., they deepen through that sharing of mutual vulnerability with one another. And you trust that person to maintain that secret. There are boundaries around it. You support each other and it stays there. And there's a loyalty around it. And all of those things are really priceless experiences. You know, those are true friendships, true marriages, etc., are a priceless gift. And to go back to the Buddha's words again, it's a way of ending, they are the entire holy life, not half of it. Thank you.